Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
I am far more concerned than what's happening at the editorial page by what's happening in news pages.
Molly Hemingway speaking at this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
In news pages, that old idea that we had for a few decades of aiming toward objectivity has just been completely thrown out the window.
And this is a generalization, but I think it bears out. And again, I mean, even 5-10 years ago, it would have sounded crazy that I'd be saying this, but I mean, I think it is the case. You have to view the explicit goal of most of the major journalistic institutions in this country as electing Democrats. And when they aren't electing Democrats, they're trying to push the Democratic Party further left.
You can watch and listen to a recording of journalists Mark and Molly Hemingway's Q&A from our 2020 Making the Case conference. It's available in both video and audio formats for a tax-deductible contribution of $250. Learn more at issuesetc.org.
I denounce white supremacy, okay?
You did 2 days later.
I've denounced white supremacy for years, but you always do it. You always start off with a question. You didn't ask Joe Biden whether or not he denounces Antifa.
If they vote out before the election, you are open to expanding the court?
I'm open to considering what happens from that point on.
You know, you've said so many times during the campaign, all through the course of your career, it's important to level with
the
American
people. It is, but
George,
if I say, no matter what answer I gave you, if I say it, that's the headline tomorrow. It won't be about what's going on now, the improper way they're proceeding.
But don't voters have a right to know where you stand?
They do have a right to know where I stand. They'll have a right to know where I stand before they vote.
So you'll come out with a clear position before Election Day?
Yes.
That's President Donald Trump and Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden speaking during their respective town halls Thursday night. Everyone acknowledges, whether they think one was better than the other, that they were two very different town halls. What made them different, and do they have any bearing on the November elections? Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the new studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to get an update on the November elections with Mark Hemingway of Real Clear Investigations and Molly Hemingway of Fox News. Then we're going to play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. We've got our soundbites ready to play. All you have to do is, in about a half hour, keep listening. And then after you've heard the 4 soundbites, give us a call, 1-877-623-MY-IE. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc, or vote at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Your votes will decide which will be Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. Joining us for an update on the November elections, Mark Hemingway. He's senior writer for Real Clear Investigations. Mark, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
And Molly Hemingway, a Fox News contributor. Molly, welcome.
Great to be here with you.
Mark, give us your thoughts on the confirmation hearings for Judge Amy Coney Barrett.
Well, they've actually gone much smoother than expected. You know, there was obviously some grandstanding by, you know, certain senators that it could be expected of, like Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, who also, you know, made, I think, a particularly unpleasant spectacle of himself during the Kavanaugh hearings. But mostly what we saw at the hearing from Democratic senators was Democrats not objecting to Coney Barrett per se, but objecting to the process, objecting to her, what they interpreted to be her broader world and legal view, without really probing her. And generally, they were trying to grandstand. So on the whole, it went smoother than expected. But I also think it's incumbent to point out that Kavanaugh's hearing went relatively smoothly. They didn't drop any of the big opposition research against him until after his hearing, but before his confirmation.
Molly, if you would, compare the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings with what we've had so far of those for Amy Coney Barrett.
Well, Mark is correct that the real craziness of the Kavanaugh hearings began after the conclusion of what were supposed to be the hearings. They reopened the hearings to have that whole circus that everybody watched. But they actually were pretty crazy. It took Chairman Grassley, who was then the chairman of the committee, like 45 minutes to get through his opening statement, because within seconds he began to be interrupted by Kamala Harris and Cory Booker and all the Democrats on the committee. And the Democrats had invited people into the gallery to get arrested. And so hundreds of people were getting arrested throughout those hearings. And they also had some pretty tough questioning of Kavanaugh, pretty hostile questioning. I don't want us to set such a low bar for Democrats that we pretend like they didn't also engage in some pretty hostile, inappropriately hostile questioning or suggestions that she was racist or whatnot that we witnessed this week. But there's no question that the hearings went far, far, far better than anybody expected. And I think that's just a result of Democrats not feeling like they had any weaponry to delay them. And sort of admitting that at the beginning made it so that they didn't engage in the same types of antics that they did against Brett Kavanaugh.
Mark, what do you make of the backlash against Dianne Feinstein after the conclusion of the hearings?
I mean, it just says a lot about the present political moment. I mean, one of the great strengths of the Senate was always supposedly that it was the body where, because you had longer terms and other things like that, allowed you to forge bonds with your fellow senators across parties, you know, to really engage in sort of civil behavior. I mean, obviously that's been eroding for a decade or more, but Dianne Feinstein's been around a long time, and she still has that tradition of old civility in the Senate, I think. And, you know, with the understanding that if you extend civility to your opponents, you know, when you're not in power again, they will extend that courtesy back to you. And that was a great tradition. And obviously with the demise of the filibuster and some other things that have happened, I would argue mostly at the behest of Democrats, and certainly as far as judicial confirmations go, there's no doubt that Democrats are largely responsible for the complete deterioration of that process. And specifically, no person is probably more responsible for the deterioration of the judicial confirmation process than Joe Biden, who tried to use his platform as Judiciary Committee chairman to first torch Bork and later Clarence Thomas's confirmations. So it's just, you know, an unfortunate commentary on where we're at, which is to say civility in politics is, you know, a thing of the past.
Molly, are you surprised that there were fewer mentions of Judge Barrett's religious beliefs and affiliations than in her confirmation hearings for the federal appellate court?
The Republicans let it be known early and often that if Democrats did to Amy Coney Barrett in this hearing what they did to her at her confirmation hearing to become a federal judge 3 years ago, that there would be major, major pushback. And it appears that that message was heard loud and clear by Democrats. In general, their attack on her for actually believing what her religious affiliation teaches just backfired horribly on them at the time. You did see, though, that the Washington Post, which serves as the publication arm of the Democrats' anti-Republican confirmation campaign, did pull a bunch of anti-religious stuff on her before the hearing. And I would assume that they will continue to do that until she is confirmed, if passed as prologue.
Molly, our mutual friend Terry Mattingly has proposed a theory this week that evangelical voters might be less likely to vote for President Trump if Barrett is confirmed. Many evangelicals voted, of course, for Trump primarily to get a majority of originalist justices on the Supreme Court. And that mission has been accomplished. Evangelicals no longer need, goes the theory, to support President Trump. What do you make of that?
I mean, it's not the silliest theory. And I think that when the vacancy occurred, a lot of people thought about holding the nomination open until after the election, precisely to motivate Republican voters. But the reasons why that theory doesn't hold up are, there are a few reasons. One, it's not entirely clear that the mission is accomplished. In fact, not clear at all that the mission is accomplished. And that's because even though President Trump has gotten three justices on the Supreme Court, there have been major disappointments with previous Republican nominees, and there are likely to be several more openings in the years to come, and no majority is permanent. And that is particularly true since everybody from Vice President Joe Biden to his running mate Kamala Harris on down are either openly admitting that they plan to pack the court to take away this victory from evangelicals and conservatives and Catholics, or they're either admitting it openly or they're not denying it in a way that makes people assume that that's what they plan to do. So the thing you can say about pro-lifers and evangelicals is that they are not idiots and they understand how this works, and they started working very hard on getting pro-lifers elected to the Senate or constitutional conservatives elected to the Senate many years ago. And it's unlikely that they think if they look at the world around them, that they have succeeded and that there's no more work to be done. So I think that having that track record of success for President Trump, not just in these three nominees that he has gotten on the court or will have gotten on the court, but the hundreds of other federal judges, I don't think people are saying, okay, we've had enough winning. We definitely can just go back and not care about this anymore.
Mark, let's turn to the twin town halls of Thursday night. How did Vice President Biden do during his?
Well, he did some things that were sort of shocking. He basically denounced the crime bill that he sponsored in the 90s and, you know, basically wrote, you know, which is, I think, a statement of where Democratic politics are. You know, normally that kind of flip-flop would be blanketing the news today, but the media is obviously choosing sides in this election. You know, and further, he made this insane statement about training cops to shoot people in the leg instead of, you know, as if some sort of like de-escalation tactic, which was just, again, under any sort of normal circumstances, you know, and absent running against an unconventional figure like Trump, people would be pointing out how spectacularly crazy this is. It's also not the first time Joe Biden has made comments about waving around firearms. So, yeah, I mean, I guess by being, you know, at the end of the day, you know, slightly more conventional in a lot of ways than Trump, he, you know, was perceived as having done well by the media. But, you know, again, Biden is not a particularly normal or competent politician, you know, for whatever odd charm and affability he might possess.
Molly, how do you think Vice President Biden did?
Well, I first off just think that both candidates last night had in-person town halls, and the fraudulent and corrupt Presidential Debate Commission told the country that they couldn't do a debate unless it was virtual, and that was clearly not true. So I'm very glad that we got to see both of these town halls. I think it's very important to have people answer questions. Joe Biden had, as per usual, the friendly, gentle caressing of a Democratic operative, George Stephanopoulos, asking him questions that were so mild that they didn't really elicit particularly interesting answers. But having said that, some of the questions from the voters at that town hall were interesting and revealed things I think people do care about, you know, whether it's his views on the crime bill, his views that 8-year-old boys who believe themselves to be girls should be encouraged in that. I think that's a very radical position that is held by very few Americans. And because a woman asked him about it, you got to see that. He did advocate for a violent response of firing guns. Like, he's done this before, too. He said that if Jill Biden ever feels threatened, she should go out on the porch and fire a shotgun. I don't think people have accurately understood what bad advice that is, that you should never use a gun unless you are sort of ready and willing to use it for its intended purpose, and that it can be very dangerous to advocate other things like that. So for Americans who want to learn more about their candidate or, you know, want to learn more about Joe Biden, it was good. I don't think the gentle questioning from friendly co-partisans is serving the country that well, but it's better than nothing.
Mark, President Trump, how did he perform during his own town hall last night?
I think he was appropriately feisty. I mean, obviously, you know, much like the first debate, there were times when I wish that Trump had a better grasp of explaining policy. In particular, there was an incident where they allowed a questioner at the town hall who was an admitted Biden supporter to come up and ask a question about Republican hypocrisy on Supreme Court judicial confirmations, and he just simply had his facts wrong. And Republicans did not say that they would never support a judicial confirmation in an election year. They said that they held off on Merrick Garland because the will of the voters wasn't clear, because there was a division of power where Democrats held the White House and Republicans held the Senate. So, you know, that was an appropriate opportunity with a long historical precedent to let the voters, you know, decide what was going to happen after the fact. You know, that's the kind of thing when you're screening questions, you know, the town hall people should catch. At the same time, you know, it's also the kind of thing where I think Trump could have done a better job of parrying that. But by and large, I mean, he seemed energetic and like Molly pointed out, you know, considering that he was basically parrying both the moderator, you know, in addition to having to answer these questions. I mean, it was a really unfair setup. And I think by and large, he did reasonably well.
Molly, Savannah Guthrie asked the president 43 questions and the town hall participants asked 10. What was going on?
Right. Savannah Guthrie did a horrible job moderating the debate. And it was really funny because when NBC agreed to do this, all of the partisan activists who control NBC News were livid, or who dominate NBC News, and the partisans who are in every other media outlet. They were so upset. They wanted last night to be a night where Joe Biden could shine without any interruption. That was the whole point in getting the debate canceled and the whole point in doing this town hall with Biden. And by Donald Trump getting to do a town hall, it ruined the plan. Savannah Guthrie, in an effort to placate presumably her colleagues and other activists, did this like cartoonishly hostile questioning. She didn't just ask 43 questions to the actual 10 questions from the normal people who are voting. She interrupted each and every single one of his responses, sometimes twice, three times, or even four times, to insert her own political views. And it was a total failure. So the whole point is to crush Donald Trump. And instead, anybody with even like mild objectivity can look at this and go, this is crazy. Like, just let the normal people ask their questions. And I see Mark's point about the guy having an error in how he asked the question. But every single one of these normal voters who was out there was able to engage with our president in a completely civil and normal way. And it was a refreshing reminder that just because our media have lost their minds doesn't mean that everybody in America has. And whether these people were voting for Trump or Biden or they weren't sure, they all had good questions, I thought. And it elicited really interesting responses. And again, you got to learn more about various policy issues. Unfortunately, Savannah Guthrie took, like, basically stole from America like 45 minutes of the hour with her personal pet obsessions on mask wearing and her pre-planned attacks on Trump based on questions that she already knew were going to be answered. And I am just so sick of this. The media need an intervention or something so that they stop attacking the American people and preventing us from just being able to learn more about our candidate.
We're getting an update on the November elections from Mark Hemingway of Real Clear Investigations and Molly Hemingway of The Federalist. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're connected to Issues Etc. If you appreciate our weekly updates with Mark and Molly Hemingway, please consider making a tax-deductible gift for the new studios and offices of Issues Etc., Lutheran Public Radio, and the Word of the Lord Endures Forever. A generous donor has provided a $200,000 match. The total cost for the building and the renovation is $375,000. No gift is too small. Make a secure online gift at issuesetc.org/newstudios. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 353, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Please write New Studios in the memo line of your check. Thanks for your support. After the break, we'll discuss George Stephanopoulos' moderation of Joe Biden's town hall.
Did you know that many LCMS military personnel and their families are unable to receive Word and Sacrament ministry due to the lack of LCMS chaplains? Ministry to the Armed Forces is looking for pastors who will answer the call to serve as a chaplain to provide Word and Sacrament ministry to the men and women who selflessly serve our nation. Find out more about this exciting ministry by contacting me, Chaplain Craig Mueller, at lcmschaps@lcms.org. That is lcmschaps@lcms.org.
Thanks to a generous donor, we've purchased a building for the new studios and offices of Issues Etc., Lutheran Public Radio, and the Word of the Lord Endures Forever.
The donor will match up to $200,000 for the purchase and renovation.
The entire cost is approximately $375,000.
You can view an architect's rendering and make a special tax-deductible gift at issuesetc.org.
Or call 618-223-8385.
Thanks for your consideration.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Concordia University Chicago is committed to keeping college affordable for all, and especially for LCMS Lutherans. We have scholarships available specifically for students who are LCMS members. This is Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia Chicago, asking you to encourage your student to check out Concordia Chicago at cuchicago.edu. And if you are interested in supporting these scholarships, please find us online at foundation@cuchicago.edu.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House, a charming three-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at siestakeyrentalgenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
He was a millionaire, playboy, financial tycoon living in Manhattan. I didn't really see the evidence of pro-life in his life. And so we had 17 primary candidates in the Republican primary for president. And so I put him last.
There's no right to an abortion, in or implied by the Constitution. It was made up out of whole cloth by the Supreme Court in 1973.
Regarding Jesus, two-thirds of evangelicals, 65%, affirm this statement. Jesus is the first and greatest being created by God. That statement is pure heresy.
It's one thing to believe something about yourself that is contrary to reality. It is a whole other thing to construct a system that requires everybody else to play along with your illusion.
10 minutes from now, we'll play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. It's a simple game we like to play with our listeners. We've got 4 soundbites to play for you. We play them for you, you listen, and then you give us a call and you vote for one of them to be Soundbite of the Week. The number, 1-877-623-MY-IE. You can also email us your vote, talkback@issuesetc.org. You can send it to us via Twitter at IssuesETC or at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/IssuesETC. We're talking about the November elections. Our guests are Mark and Molly Hemingway. Mark, we talked about Savannah Guthrie before the break. How would you contrast the moderation of George Stephanopoulos of Joe Biden's town hall?
Well, I mean, obviously it was night and day. I mean, you know, as you pointed out, there was, you know, an enormous amount of, you know, questions asked and interruptions by Savannah Guthrie, which, you know, she was supposed to just facilitate the town hall, not, you know, be, you know, personally debating Donald Trump. Whereas the George Stephanopoulos thing, I mean, it wasn't just that there were softballs being lobbed by George Stephanopoulos. I mean, it seemed like the entire event was done to cater to Biden. I mean, for instance, you know, one of the questioners at the debate was a former Obama speechwriter that they were trying to pass off as an ordinary voter. Similarly, when Stephanopoulos directly asked Biden about the crime bill, when he reversed himself and all that, does the average voter know that George Stephanopoulos was the advisor to President Bill Clinton when Bill Clinton signed Joe Biden's, you know, crime bill? I mean, that's the kind of like weird conflict of interest that in a functioning press corps should never be allowed to happen. But yet it does, because you can literally be a former, you know, have a career as a Democratic operative and then go into the media and get a job probing Democrats running for office on behalf of the American people. And it's just entirely unfair and ridiculous.
Molly, are you at all surprised that, as you mentioned, the NBC's, many people with the NBC organization were basically declaring the end of the world yesterday, but today are just as happy as they can be?
It's just important that people understand the media currently in operation do not exist to disseminate news or information. They have one goal. It's a partisan political goal, and they are doing everything in their power to accomplish that. I do want to just say one other thing about the Stephanopoulos town hall, which is that last week there was a town hall where it was revealed that there were problems with the questioners who claimed to be undecided, but in fact were Democratic activists. And last night, these were supposed to be undecided voters, and one of the people was like literally a former Obama speechwriter or something like that. So our media are willing to throw out all standards repeatedly. They don't care about getting caught. And it really is a problem. I know I sound heated about this, but it is very, very bad when we have so many media people operating completely openly and constantly their one goal of making sure Donald Trump is not elected. It's fine if they personally feel that, they're doing a disservice to Americans by interfering in elections as much as they are.
Mark, with all that said, will there be another presidential debate?
Honestly, you know, I don't think Biden wants one. At the same time, he's got questions about his health and other things like that, where I think it would be a mistake for him to turn it down. But at the same time, it's entirely possible that the Biden campaign might be so overconfident in its polling that they, you know, just, you know, turn it down as a matter of course and not go through with it. I mean, I'd be surprised if that happens. I mean, they, you know, put things off to chance, because there will be a lot of questions asked if Biden turns it down.
Molly, the New York Post has written a series of stories about Vice President Biden's son, Hunter. What can you tell us about these stories, and is there any connection to Joe Biden himself?
Oh, there's quite a bit of connection to Joe Biden in these stories. New York Post, and actually a few other media outlets, have reported that there are emails on a computer that reportedly belong to Hunter Biden between Hunter Biden and foreign oligarchs, dealing with how he was able to sell access to his family for a personal financial gain. And the emails were on a computer that was left, we're told, at a computer repair shop in Delaware, and then not claimed again. And then once that happens, the person who owns the repair shop can access those things. And he did, and he turned it over to the FBI, and he also turned it over to people close to the Trump campaign. And so these emails are interesting in part because we had an impeachment earlier this year based on the claim that it was completely inappropriate to have any concerns about Hunter Biden selling access to the Obama-Biden administration. So having evidence that that is what was happening, even though we all, or many people understood that's what was happening, but the media tried to suppress that information. So this is very newsworthy. And it's not just about Hunter Biden, who has his own issues. It's about pretty much everybody in the Biden family having gotten very wealthy because of their ability to sell access to Joe Biden. And Joe Biden and his wife himself, they always talk about how they came from very humble means and now they're multimillionaires, and people understand that there are these ways that you can become quite wealthy if you create policies that favor elites. This is kind of like the big issue of our elections in recent years, is whether some of these policies, whether they're about immigration or how we fight foreign wars or how we get involved in different international affairs or how we bail out large companies or, you know, any number of things, they definitely help elite families. And there is the argument from a lot of Americans that these policies have not served America very well, that they haven't served our national security very well, or they've hurt the middle class or destroyed the middle class. And so even though this is dealing with some, you know, pretty salacious stuff about one family, it really gets at the larger issue of whether the people get to have a say in how their country is run or not.
Mark, what did you make of the appearance of these stories from the New York Post, and in particular, how social media responded?
We need to get some things pretty clear up front, which is that there is absolutely no question that Hunter Biden is corrupt, and he has used his father's status as Vice President of the United States and a former senator to enrich himself. And we need to be asking a lot of questions about whether or not this in any way, shape, or form was done with Joe Biden's knowledge. It's also not just Hunter Biden. Joe Biden's brother, James, has been up to his eyeballs in corrupt business deals that appear to involve, again, trading off the influence of his brother. The FBI raided a company that James was involved in earlier this year. Last year, in an interview in The New Yorker, Hunter Biden admitted in an interview with The New Yorker, which is not exactly a right-wing publication, that he was given an $80,000 bribe in the form of a diamond delivered to his hotel room with a Chinese tycoon that's connected to the Communist Party. I mean, the idea that The New York Post would publish a story that alleges that Hunter Biden is involved in shady deals with, you know, Russian and Ukrainian businessmen, which, you know, we know he had that crazy corrupt deal with sitting on the board of Burisma that paid him $100,000 a month. And the default assumption by social media companies was that they needed to block the story from being disseminated, which is Facebook limited the story. And Twitter initially, like, prohibited people from tweeting the link and then slapped a warning on it for days. The idea that they would preemptively assume that that was disinformation, given the facts that we know and have been established, is absolutely outrageous. And people need to be very, very aware of what is going on in this country. I mean, the tech companies are very comfortable with oligarchy. They've made their own money, and they would be perfectly fine setting up some sort of like totalitarian corporate state like China, where they get to profit off of it while the rest of us get ground under the wheels of the machinery of the state. I mean, this is really, really dangerous stuff. And if people don't start fighting back against this and doing something to put political pressure to curb these companies from even thinking about playing an outsized role in censoring political debates in one-sided and arbitrary ways that favor their own political candidates, I don't know what to say. I mean, we're going to be in real deep trouble if we don't do something about that.
Molly, what are the odds that the Democrats win the Senate?
Oh, I don't know, and I haven't checked recently, so I'm loath to get into it. But, gosh, there are a bunch of really interesting races, and a lot of them are really coming down to the wire, whether it's Susan Collins in Maine or Tom Tillis seeking re-election in North Carolina. Michigan has a really hot race going on right now with a chance to unseat a Democratic incumbent. I think that everything is going to end up with how Trump does. Republican senators have tried desperately to distance themselves from President Trump, and in fact, sometimes to even sabotage him. Just this week, you had Ben Sasse, a senator from Nebraska, talking to his constituents and just trashing President Trump in some interesting ways. But I don't think Republican senators quite understand that their fate is tied very much with President Trump. So if he does well, they'll do well. He pulls ahead of Republican senators in many cases, in most cases that matter. And their strategy of having tried to like not help him during his administration might not go as well as planned. I talked with one leader once who said that his goal was to get people to vote like for the Republican senator, but not for the president. And I really was surprised that he didn't understand that probably if there were split tickets, they wouldn't go in the Republican senator's favor. But it's going to be tight. Democrats definitely, definitely have a shot at taking the Senate, particularly if Trump goes down, and they know it and they are acting like it.
Mark, what are the odds that the Republicans regain the House?
I mean, I think in both cases, Democrats are both slightly favored to retain, to gain control of the Senate. And given the lead that Democrats have established, you know, already in terms of the margin they have in leadership in the Senate, it would be very unlikely Republicans gain control of the House. Less likely the Republicans can gain control of the House than they maintain control of the Senate. But we've seen some crazy things. And I just want to emphasize a few weeks out from the polls, that the actual polls, as opposed to the real polls, that the polling information that we're so reliant upon, there's a lot of, you know, crazy stuff that has been happening in the last few election cycles with polls, and the media establishment and, you know, the Washington establishment are so like reliant on polls to, as a matter of confirmation bias, to tell them what they want to think. It doesn't take much for a bunch of different polls to be wrong, even wrong within the margin of error, to completely swing an election. So I wouldn't put much stock in anything at this point in time. You know, this is a very divided country. I mean, I think we know that, very evenly divided. And I would just go to the polls and vote how you want to vote.
Molly, with about a minute, do you think that the Democratic Party retains the House in this election?
I think so, just because they have enough of a margin. Usually in a midterm, you see massive gains for the out party. And you saw that in the House in 2018. You did not see that in the Senate because of the Kavanaugh confirmation and how Democrats performed there. But I don't think that they'll, you know, you won't see like increases for Democrats like you saw in 2018, and they might lose a couple of vulnerable seats. Just to echo what Mark said, though, I did write a piece earlier this week looking at how Trump is polling in battleground states right now versus 4 years ago. And even though the media narrative is that it's all over but the shout and Biden's going to win in a landslide, he's actually polling about the same in those battleground states as he was 4 years ago. Now, 4 years ago, he made some major gains in the closing weeks, so he needs to do that this time, too. But just a lot of action can happen, even with so many people early voting in these last few weeks.
You can read Mark and Molly Hemingway's columns at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Mark Hemingway is senior writer for Real Clear Investigations. Mark, thank you.
Thank you.
Molly Hemingway is a Fox News contributor, senior editor of The Federalist, and co-author of the book, Justice on Trial. Molly, thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back from the break, it's time to play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. We've got one from Marjorie Dannenfelser, is Donald Trump pro-life? Dr. Matthew Frank, is Roe v. Wade constitutional? Pastor Paul McCain, The Church Without Creeds, and Glenn Stanton, Can You Believe Something Wrong About Yourself? Your votes for Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week on the other side of the break. What's the relationship between the Book of Proverbs and the Ten Commandments? Find out with the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, Provoking Proverbs, Wisdom, and the Ten Commandments. It's a new 10-lesson Bible study produced by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number 1-800-325-3040, or read an excerpt of Provoking Proverbs at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, Provoking Proverbs, Wisdom, and the Ten Commandments. 1-800-325-3040.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com. and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR21. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Deaconesses are women trained to share the gospel of Jesus Christ through works of mercy, spiritual care, and teaching of the Christian faith. The word deaconess means servant. Find out more on how you can serve in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod through the vocation of deaconess at lcms.org/deaconess. Working in faith, laboring in love, remaining steadfast in the hope of our Lord Jesus Christ. LCMS Deaconess Ministry, lcms.org/deaconess.
I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel, writes St. Paul in his opening salvo to the Galatians. There is indeed no other gospel than that which we taught to you. And that's what the October issue of the Lutheran Witness is all about, the gospel proclaimed to you through the letter of St. Paul to the Galatians. Visit witness.lcms.org to learn more. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by becoming an Issues Etc. congregational sponsor. Ascension Lutheran, Niles, Illinois. Christ Our Savior Lutheran, Freeburg, Illinois. Good Shepherd Lutheran, Marshall, Minnesota. Hope Lutheran, Spokane Valley, Washington. Messiah Lutheran, Keller, Texas. Our Savior Lutheran, Louisville, Kentucky. Redeemer Lutheran, Lincoln, Nebraska. St. John Lutheran, New Berlin, Illinois. St. Paul Lutheran, International Falls, Minnesota. And Trinity Lutheran, Okmulgee, Oklahoma. Find out how your confessional Lutheran church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Support, Donate, and print the one-page flyer. When your congregation becomes an Issues Etc. sponsor, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal.